Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Better late than never, Trump Secretary of State Marco Rubio admits America's unipolar moment has passed. Viewers of this program understood this long ago. How will this admission make Trump's foreign policy different? Will diplomacy make a comeback? Cross-talking Trump's foreign policy, I'm joined by my guest, Daniel Lazar, in New York. He is a journalist and author of three books on the U.S. Constitution. In Nashville, we have Ryan Christian. He is founder and editor of The Last American Vagabond, as well as co-founder of the Independent Media Alliance. And in Brisbane, we cross to Warwick Powell. He is an adjunct professor at Queensland University and Technology and senior fellow at the Taihei Institute. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, so much to talk about here. I was leading, obviously, in my introduction. I'm going to quote Marco Rubio right now. It's not normal for the world to have a unipolar power. Remarkable coming from a Secretary of State. And then on the heels of this, we have the, well, it seems to be the imminent destruction of USAID, at least in its current or its former incarnation. We don't know where it's going to go from here. The point is, my friend, so much is happening. I think they're related. Take it from here, Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing is a global crash of neoliberalism. And it reminds me of the crash of communism in 1989 to 91. I think the world is going through a major phase change. The rules of the last 35 years or so have fallen apart, and we're entering into a new era. And that era is based on multipolarity, intense international competition, the destruction of old alliances, like, you know, NATO is going the way of the Warsaw Pact. So it's really a dramatic change that we're the world is passing through.
Ryan, is this all a good thing? Go ahead.
I'd like to start with pointing out that I think in general, the destruction of USAID is obviously a positive thing, if ultimately that is what happens to it, because I think it's one of the things that is being debated, which is frustrating for a lot of us that have followed along with what it's been doing, is that there's some ultimate positive, net positive outcome to what it does. I disagree with that. I think it's a regime change engine with some things that are done positive around it, ultimately as cover, I would argue. But I think what I'm worried about here is that the process, I think, is important. And I think the way this is going is indicating to me that this is more about framing it as a positive change in order to roll in what I worry is a worse outcome. And but like we were kind of saying off air before, it's a win nonetheless to see this begin to go that step. But I think what I'm seeing a lot across the Trump administration right now is taking things that we've always wanted to go away and framing it as a positive destruction, but really already rolling in something that I see as much worse, sort of like the digital end of this, the CBDC direction, or more private end to that. But that's what I see happening here with Musk and the rest of this and the way it's going, or Marco Rubio taking control or merging it with the State Department when it already really was. It just seems more of a shell game to me. But I'm going to wait and see how it plays out. But I think if it was going to be done right, it should have been done in a way that was more transparent and not only focused on the left has been doing this the entire time. That's just dishonest.
Yeah, I agree with you, because it's settling domestic political scores also, very much so, because this is what's shown as being the machinations of the Democratic Party. They've said this very openly, so you're absolutely right. But Warwick, kind of drawing upon what Daniel had to say, what is really interesting is that, you know, with the end of the Cold War, the end of the Soviet Union, the end of the Warsaw Pact, we had, you know, kind of a, I was going to say ideological void, but we actually had a preponderance of neoliberalism around the world. I agree with Daniel 100%, and we're not on the same frequency when it comes to many, many politics here. But it's good to see that go. Will be less of an ideological world. That's a plus. But is it going back to just great power rivalry, which has its pluses and minuses, too? Go ahead, in Brisbane.
Yeah, look, it's good to be with you, Peter, especially after the last time we tried to connect. So greetings to you and Happy New Year. Look, I think that there's no doubt that the 35-year period of neoliberalism is coming to an end. And, in fact, for most people who've been watching these things closely for a number of years, it ended a little while ago. It's just taken the United States leadership, I guess, or the political elite or sections of the political elite to come to terms with that reality. But I think it also spells the end of a 500-year period of liberal, Western liberal colonial dominance. So we've got two endings in a sense. One is a short-term ending, which is a 35-year period of a particularly intense type of Western neoliberalism. But we're also seeing fundamental changes in the way that the global economic system is organised, and as a result of that, the ways in which countries interact with each other. So it is a momentous period that we're living through, and you know, and it's going to reverberate for quite some time, because there's a whole bunch of vested interests who don't want to let go, and they will fight tooth and nail, of course, to hang on to what they've had, and the struggle, in a sense, is going to continue for a little while yet before the dust settles.
Yes, because no one likes to give up power, and this neoliberalism is a powerful, if not toxic, force. It will not give up easily as well. But Daniel, I mean, you know, I mentioned great power politics. Okay, for me, it'll be a relief not to hear Secretary of State, well, we're only doing this for democracy around the world. You know, I think we're all tired of all of that. Okay, but then on the other side of the ledger is Trump says he's going to take Greenland and Panama. Okay. I mean, not for democratic reasons either, for just pure national, selfish national interest here. I mean, that's the flip side of it, isn't it, Daniel?
Yeah. I mean, the U.S. unipolarity is not unprecedented. We saw British unipolarity for a 99-year period from 1815 to 1914. Then that collapsed. And we all know what happened next. Trump is you know, he sees himself as a conqueror. He's picking fights with minor parties that he certainly can win. I mean, it's no big deal for the U.S. to steamroll over Canada or Mexico or Panama or Denmark, for that matter. But the point is that the old peace is falling apart in a very dramatic fashion. And no one knows how it'll shake out. No one knows what China's reaction will be. No one quite knows what Russia's reaction will be.
Well, you know, Ryan, one of the outcomes of all of this is that the alliance system that we have been in place, it's been in place since the Second World War, will start to unravel. I think certainly it's already been mentioned that NATO may find its fate is that it doesn't, the U.S. doesn't need NATO the way it did before, because it's not an ideological conflict, according to at least someone like Marco Rubio. Go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, but I think it's worth considering that there might be more global collaboration on certain directions that we see than not in a lot of these different things. Like, I definitely agree with what both other panelists are saying in the context of what seems to be changing. But again, I would like to argue that I really worry about how that is, you know, whether it's a change, is that even a positive change, when you're really just seeing two different establishment powers fight over who controls our lives. You know, that's what I kind of see happening. But I worry that there's more collaboration on, like, during the COVID-19 era, which is not really done. We saw a lot of global collaboration on things that really concerned a lot of people that were going in the direction of more of a world power. And I worry that that might be, in a way, what some of these are going in the direction of, even though it does seem to be more, you know, Trump taking for his own interest or for the United States interest or the government. But if you look at it on a grander scale, like what we're looking at with Canada and even Panama included, or Mexico, you're talking about something that's been discussed for a long time, North American Union dynamic. You know, coming off the conversation of something like the European Union, it's the same kind of idea. And I think this is going very clearly away from the idea of freedom and liberty. And I think that what's the problem is that because we're seeing things go away that we argue are obviously bad, that it's tricking a lot of Americans into feeling like we're going in a positive direction toward freedom, when I see all of the directions they're taking as dramatically the other direction, even if we're seeing positive things come down. And again, we'll see what comes up underneath it. That's how I kind of see it right now. But I see these things as positive steps. But if they're simply rolling out, like the Fed goes away and it's simply a private stablecoin CBDC dynamic, then that's not a positive change. That's how I see this.
Yeah, but Warwick, I think also, you know, the word sovereignty is really important here. And, you know, pursuing a sovereignty policy like Trump appears to be doing, that it also encourages other countries to do exactly the same thing. I mean, I'm beginning to think, and this is early days, but I wonder if, you know, the ideas about international law in cooperation of the second half of the 20th century is going to be forgotten. We're going to go right back to the 19th century. Go ahead, Warwick.
Look, I don't know if we'll go all the way back to the 19th century, but of course, history can often rhyme a little bit. I think one of the things that we are seeing and is that is not necessarily a complete return to great power politics yet, but a recognition by the United States that the foundations of its global hegemony and its global power are no longer there, and therefore it's going to have to recalibrate its position, at least in the short term. Whether that is a short-term recalibration that leads to a long-term systemic change, or whether it's really an attempt to regroup, is another question altogether. The recognition, I think, that the debacle in Ukraine is tantamount to a strategic defeat for the West, NATO, and of course the United States, which is the predominant financier and provider of weapons into Ukraine, the mess that is in the Middle East at the moment, and of course the diminution of American primacy in Asia has all driven, I think, a very realist Trump administration.
Yeah, but Warwick, before we go to the break, let me just ask you a quick question, Aaron, because, you know, we've bandied about the term hegemony, but, you know, primacy is not the same thing. Trump wants primacy. His administration is apparently not going to strive for hegemony. They're two different things. Real quick, before we go to the break.
Yeah, look, I think he's looking to look to use some Australian colloquialisms. He's going to mark his territory,
yeah,
like a dog marks their territory, and that's the first thing that he's going to do. And clearly, he's doing that. My read of that is that in part it's a tacit recognition of the defeat of the United States as a global hegemon. That era is over, and that goes with the demise of neoliberalism and the reassertion of American preponderance over its own sphere.
Okay, we're going to end out this part of the program on preponderance, and we'll discuss it in the second half here. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's foreign policy. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Trump's new foreign policy. Okay, let's go back to Daniel in New York. The title of this program is Tax Americana. And the reason why I put that there is because it seems that in light of what we have said already in this program, that there's a transition going on from Pax Americana to Tax Americana. Trump has this amazing affinity for tariffs, taxes. He doesn't push sanctions so much, but I mean that's still in the cards. It's kind of I'm trying to break bread here with Ryan because you know these tools here can be very much associated with the behavior of neoliberalism. It may not be espouse the same ideology, but it looks for the same outcomes. Daniel.
Oh, I don't think it does. I disagree with that. I think that that neoliberalism strove for a new world order under U.S. hegemony, and I think that Trump is bringing in a new system based on national egotism. His tariffs
is that a good thing? National egoism, is that a good thing?
No, it's not a good thing at all. It's a very bad thing. It's beggar thy neighbor policies of precisely the same as the same type we saw in the early 30s. I mean, it's one thing if Trump imposes tariffs, but if every other country imposes tariffs in retaliation, then world trade goes to zero very, very fast. And with that comes a serious economic contraction. So Trump is, you know, he's bringing in a new order, unquestionably, but it's not a good new order.
Well, I can absolutely see where you're coming from here. But, Brian, as we're speaking right now, Colombia, Panama, Mexico, and Canada have taken the knee. Is Trump onto something?
Well, I mean, obviously, if we're just talking about whether or not he wins in his political dynamic, then he's gaining. But ultimately, this is, I think, a negative thing, whether we're talking about the way the world sees the United States policy or whether we're just whether the United States is in any way what it pretends to be to the world. Right. I mean, it's just this imperialism, naked imperialism, the way he's carrying this out, whether through tariffs or not. It's belligerent, in my opinion. And I again go back to the point that I think this is about like he was. It's interesting. You talked about like the old dynamic of New World Order neoliberalism, but, you know, in comparison to what he's doing today. But I frankly think it's just kind of the merging of all this stuff. This is going in that direction of a global power. But look, I mean, it's hard to see it when you think through Trump only as this nationalistic kind of, you know, America first. But that's not really what their policies are when you look at a broader dynamic. Look at the war. I don't see much deviation between Biden and Trump's policy when it comes to foreign policy for Ukraine, for Israel. And I think, quite frankly, we're seeing a lot kind of just break down in that very basically U.S. government throwing all of its agendas out for the interest of other foreign policy agendas for Israel, for example. And so if we're talking about the tariffs, we're talking about the, you know, Canada-Mexico dynamic, we're watching things implode, things that have destroyed previous bipartisan or just, you know, any both Democrat and Republican administrations from before that we're trying to accomplish, or just the basic idea of the rules-based order that has completely collapsed because of their foreign policy. That's not in America's interest. Even right now, what Trump is doing, you can argue there's interest in resources and X, Y, and Z, but as you were pointing out, the tariffs are only going to begin to cause more international problems for both countries. Even though you see some beginning to take the knee, as you put it, I think it's only going to spin out further when other countries react. And so I see a net negative in all of this, other than imperialism for Trump.
Yeah, I mean, Warwick, I mean, we could reconfigure this entire conversation in the sense that Trump wants to have a fortress Western Hemisphere. I mean, it includes, apparently, Greenland here. It looks like, you know, he wants a power block, okay? And Ryan is absolutely right. I mean, as we speak right now, the Israeli prime minister is visiting the United States. We'll see if Marco Rubio's approach to the world, you know, when he was on Megyn Kelly, what's going on with USAID, that may all be a sideshow in a new cycle time, considering the vested interest that the Biden administration, and apparently we'll find out the Trump administration has with the genocide going on in Gaza.
Yeah, look, I don't think that there is a coherent strategy at this point in time. I think that there is a coherent ethos, which I guess others have described here as a form of nationalism or a national egoism. But what we're seeing is a whole bunch of initiatives or actions that, you know, seek to satisfy particular constituencies and also seek to create particular emotional responses from the political base. But that's largely about it at the moment. So we don't have a coherent strategy in relation to Ukraine. Promises of solving that in 24 hours, notwithstanding the fact that it was probably campaign hyperbole, have amounted to nothing at this point in time. And I'm not convinced that there is actually a meaningful strategy at all to bring that war to a meaningful close. There's certainly no strategy in relation to stabilizing the Middle East, and I don't believe that there is a strategy in relation to the Asia Pacific either. All there is at the moment is a consolidation move, which is around the backyard, so to speak, and an assertion of regional authority over neighbors who quite clearly are not in the same league. You know, it's a pretty easy thing to do. As for tariffs, you know, the reality is that the United States no longer wields the big stick that it once did, you know, and that's mainly because the United States contributes no more than 15% of global world trade today, which is down from 20% only 6 years ago. Frankly, it is just less important, relatively speaking, and so it has less impact in terms of its policies. BRICS nations are able to adjust should there be a 100% tariff imposed on them within, I would estimate, 2.5 to 3 years to fully compensate for the loss of the US market. The US, in the meantime, will take between 5 and 10 years and possibly even longer to adjust to a loss of the industrial machinery, the robotics, not to mention the raw materials that comes from the rest of the world. You know, when you've been living on the vapors of IOUs for the last 35, 40 years, and you come to the realization that at some point a real economy needs real things, it's a bit of a shocking realization. But the world doesn't need American IOUs in the way it once did. That's just the reality.
You know, Daniel, this new approach, and I think all of us would agree, it's in its formative stage right now. Or maybe it's just a one-off. They wanted to go after this agency. Ned could follow, which would be great, in my opinion. But, Daniel, given the trajectory, at least, is Trump's approach making the world more or less safe?
Oh, it's making it far less safe. I mean, first of all, number one, I mean, Hefner, you talk about things like, you use phrases like Trump's approach. Trump is a highly erratic individual.
Yep.
He is a really a mad king. There's a certain kind of logic in what he's doing, but he has not thought this out fully, and he's going to get in big trouble very, very soon. The destabilizing effects are profound. I mean, I think the weakening of NATO will have dramatic effects throughout the Eurasian continent. And it might actually heat the war up in Ukraine rather than tamping it down. This is, and of course, the Middle East. I mean, Netanyahu is now Trump's bosom pal. He is the Trump whisperer. And so essentially, he's running the entire Middle East as a proxy for the U.S. And that is pretty extraordinary. And that does not bode a more peaceful region, obviously.
I'd like to point out, though, that I... Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. Jump in.
Well, I'd like to point out that I think that it's worth considering, and I'm of the opinion that it's possibly the other way around, right? The idea that we're watching all of these things that, as you pointed out, are not in the, I mean, you could say, for instance, Greenland and minerals, or, you know, resources. There's an interest for America that might be positive for short-term gain or maybe long-term gain. But ultimately, it's, I think, like I said, a net positive in a lot of different reasons that are imploding a lot of things for long-term American interests. And I think that that benefits Israel in a lot of ways. And that's more abstract, I think, for some people, unless you understand some long-term policy that, and well, just to be frank, that people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and some of their more radical people are openly talking about, which is destabilization of foreign countries, weaponized migration. These are public statements by them, just so that's clear. But so thinking about how these things, like even with NATO, I think you could argue that these things benefit what they're trying to accomplish in the world. And let's not forget that even the promises of ending funding for Ukraine or Israel, for that matter, both have been broken. Even recently, despite the pause, even though they let Israel and Egypt continue, Trump then through Poland, through Israel, sent weapons back to Ukraine. That just happened. So it just seems to be even challenging his own promises to his base. I think I see all of this as in the interest of at least foreign countries as opposed to the United States, but I would say Israel. And I think that's worth considering.
Warwick, last 40 seconds go to you. Given what we've heard from Daniel and Ryan, is there a coherent strategy here? Go ahead, 35 seconds.
There's no coherent strategy. It's a series of emotionally driven reactions to changes in the world that Trump is coming to grips with. It is a function of a deep state of displacement anxiety from a country and a man who's experienced a world that was dramatically different and where the United States sat at the pinnacle. That's no longer the case.
It's quite fascinating. The new administration has inherited a world very, very different than the first administration of Trump. It's really quite fascinating. And I guess we'll all agree. We'll see where it all goes. It's very difficult to keep track of what's going on here. I want to thank my guests in Nashville, New York, and in Brisbane. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.